Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland, and I'm your hostess for this evening, and I welcome you to our show. Patriot Education, as always, is brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamily.com, a great group of people who believe in this country and the principles upon which it was founded. We are the nation, ladies and gentlemen, and we act it every day. Tonight's topic is tough teachers, monsters or magicians? Well, the answer to the question is neither. But tough teachers are a benefit to our kids. A teacher friend of mine posted a link to an article in the Wall Street Journal on Facebook the other day, and when I read it, I decided to use it as the springboard for tonight's discussion. In the article, which is by Joanne Lippman, the author talks about the fact that a tough teacher is much more likely to engender confidence and grit in his or her students. Progressives have been spending a great deal of time over the last 30 years telling us that children are delicate little blossoms who must never face harsh winds, must live in a hothouse atmosphere of feel-good praise based on no achievement, and take over the classroom and learn under their own guidance. Well, we've seen how that's worked out. We are, according to the article that I read from Wall Street Journal, behind 12 other nations, our 15-year-olds are, in science, and behind 17 in math. We are so fond of agonizing over our poor, delicate little children not being made to feel good about themselves that we've forgotten that feeling good about yourself only comes from achievement. It cannot be given. It must be earned. In the article called Why Tough Teachers Get Good Results, the woman who wrote it has put together 8 points that seem to be borne out as truisms by various specialists in psychology and in learning matters. Being a tough teacher myself, I applaud this article, and I found that I use every single one of these 8 bullet points. Number one, a little pain is good for you. Progressives are very fond of telling us that a pain-free, risk-free, perfectly safe life is achievable and desirable, and if you only give up your freedom, government will secure that pain-free, risk-free, perfectly safe life for you. Well, if you never experience pain, what are you going to do when something actually does start to hurt? There is, I'm quoting now from the article, psychologist K. Anders Ericsson gained fame for his research showing that true expertise requires about 10,000 hours of practice, a notion popularized by Malcolm Gladwell in his book Outliers. But an often overlooked finding from the same study is equally important. True expertise requires teachers who give, quote, constructive, even painful, feedback, unquote, as Dr. Ericsson put it in a 2007 Harvard Business Review article. He assessed research on top performers in fields ranging from violin performance to surgery to computer programming to chess. And he found that all of them, quote, deliberately picked unsentimental coaches who would challenge them and drive them to higher levels of performance, end quote. The number of students who tell me after a day or so in my ISS classroom, gee, Mrs. Rowland, you sure are strict, but I got a lot done and I learned a lot while I was in here. I guess being a tough teacher is not necessarily a bad thing. Life is tough, ladies and gentlemen, and our kids have to grow a slightly thicker skin in order to live through adolescence. My personal belief, ladies and gentlemen, is that the quote-unquote epidemic of teen suicides due to bullying is only because we try to protect our children so much from hearing a harsh word or believing that not everybody in the world loves them and wishes to worship at their feet, that when they are given harsh words, their immediate reaction is, take my life, I'm dead, nobody loves me, I will leave the earth. I think if we had more constructive and even painful criticism of behaviors, attitudes, and laziness, that our kids would be a heck of a lot more resilient. And we wouldn't hear every other week of another teenager who has taken an overdose of pills or hanged himself because somebody called him a dirty name on Facebook. The anti-bullying campaign that's going on this month, because October is anti-bullying month, instead of teaching kids how to stand up under the pressure of their idiot peers, especially a bully who derives his satisfaction and fills his emptiness by making others feel pain, would be a much more constructive way of dealing with it than the kumbaya moments and the acting out of what should you do, tell a teacher, what should you do, tell a parent, what should you do, go to the guidance counselor. It teaches kids that they can't stand up for themselves, that they've got to go somewhere else to get help for their delicate feelings because somebody has called them a name or somebody won't sit with them at lunch or somebody makes fun of the clothes they wear. Yes, bullies are nasty creatures. Yes, treating another human being in that fashion is wrong. But so is treating the human being who's being bullied as a potential professional victim. I would rather see our kids learn how to pop the bully in the mouth than sit down and talk it out, because bullies are not interested in talking it out. They are incapable of filling their own inner emptiness with anything other than someone else's pain. The bully's mantra could very well be, misery loves company. And all the kumbaya moments in the world will not make up for a dysfunctional family life, or physical or intellectual limitations, or the example of older brothers and sisters or parents who shout and scream at one another and use physical violence to impose their will. The only person I have ever heard of in my life who probably could have gotten by with, oh, I love you, stop bullying, is Jesus Christ. And when he did it, he was crucified for it. I do not believe that our function as teachers is to make our children into sacrificial martyrs to hang upon the cross, to basically induce everybody to say, gee, I'm sorry, I will never bully anybody again. Because even after Christ was crucified, Rome didn't sit back and say, oh, gee, I'm sorry. Okay, everybody, come sit down to my table, and you're a happy Roman citizen. I don't care what you believe in. No. It took how many years for Constantine to convert the Roman Empire to Christianity? And he did it as a political move. A little pain, a little discomfort, a little anguish is a part of growing up, ladies and gentlemen. There is no guarantee that everyone in this world is going to love you, or even necessarily like you. And they certainly aren't going to agree with you. And if our kids do not understand this by the time they get to high school, then we are failing them. Bullet point number two regarding tough teachers is drill, baby, drill. And I'm not talking about the Keystone Pipeline or the Anwar oil fields. Rote learning, memorization skills, knowing your times tables, knowing your addition and subtraction facts, knowing the dates of the American Revolution and the Civil War, knowing the names of the kings of England, knowing the names of and how many wives Henry VIII had. Memory does not become better when you don't exercise it. You have to train children to use their memorization skills. They cannot memorize things without assistance, without practice. They can't even remember language unless they are hearing it every day from infancy. If you want children to have that vaunted, wonderful thing, math fluency, which the Department of Education mentioned 17 times in its report that they don't have it, math fluency is knowing that if 7 plus 9 is 16, then 16 minus 9 equals 7, and 16 minus 7 equals 9. And knowing it as well as you know where to find your super-duper high-end sneakers and put them on your feet before you go to school. It's the same mistake that was made with reading 25 years ago, ladies and gentlemen. Throwing the baby out with the bathwater is a popular progressive sport. You cannot understand and do algebraic equations if you have to pull out your calculator to add 3 plus 2. Because you have no understanding of the relationship of the four operations with numbers. You can't see the pattern if you never memorize the facts. With reading, they threw out phonics and decided that sight reading was the way to go. Well, that's dandy for snark words, but it doesn't help you much when you come across a word like prestidigitation and have absolutely no clue how to spell it out enough to be able to find the doggone thing in the dictionary. Hearing a word you don't know and looking it up in a dictionary is a useless activity if you have no clue what letter under which to find the word. My friend Linda tells me that that was in Portland, Oregon when she was about a year old, and her parents were appalled when they heard about it. Her dad was a teacher. And I was appalled when I saw what they were doing when I was working as a tutor. The kids need both sight reading skills and phonics in order to decode words that are unfamiliar and to recognize words that do not fit into the basic rules of phonetics. English is an extraordinarily difficult language to learn as a second language. It is the second most difficult language in the world. It is only exceeded in difficulty by Chinese, and that because Chinese is a tonal language, so that a rising or falling tone on the same syllable can change the meaning of the word completely. English contains approximately 29 phonemes, in other words, sounds, with which we create words. And in English, these individual phonemes are often spelled anywhere from 2 to 6 different ways. So pure phonics is not going to get you through philology, for example. But pure sight reading isn't going to help either, because it's unlikely that you will ever see the word philology unless you're in college. Both things are a part of reading and reading comprehension. In math comprehension, one of the most difficult tasks I have in working with middle school students is to get them to make the switch between thinking arithmetically and thinking mathematically. Arithmetic is about an answer. It's about the four operations with whole numbers, fractions, decimals, and percents. What you're looking for is the right answer. Algebra is about mathematical concepts. It's about why numbers do what they do and how to make them do what you need them to solve a problem. It's about learning steps based on the way numbers work. You cannot leave arithmetic out and still do algebra, and you cannot spend your life only relying on arithmetic and a calculator and ever progress past arithmetic. The two things are absolutely necessary. I can vividly remember, ladies and gentlemen, when the quote-unquote new math was introduced in our public schools. Not only did the children not learn anything, their parents were ready to tear out their own hair as well as the teachers and their kids. Because the incredibly wonderful progressive thought process in this was that if you just expose them to things, then the mathematical concepts will just seep in by osmosis and they will absolutely understand distributive property. Guess what, folks? It doesn't work. I spent approximately 4 hours yesterday getting 2 8th grade students to understand how to solve an equation with only one variable when they had to move things from one side of an equal sign to the other. Like 3x plus 2 equals 5x minus 8. Okay? They had no clue. They were given the basics, the pre-algebra basics, but neither of them remembered the rules for adding and subtracting integers or multiplying and dividing them. Everything went into the calculator. 6 plus 3 went into the calculator. Negative 6 plus negative 5 went into the calculator. And they had no clue how to do that on a calculator. I was almost ready to take the calculators, put them on the floor, and jump up and down on them and scream madly. I didn't, because although a little fear doesn't hurt in the classroom, thinking that your teacher has gone absolutely bananas and calling for the men in the white coats is not necessarily a good learning atmosphere. And I like to try to create a good learning atmosphere. But this is part and parcel of the lack of memorization skills. I have kids tell me, Mrs. Rowland, how do you remember all that stuff? Well, Mrs. Rowland remembers that stuff because she practiced it and she listened and she made herself memorize it. It astonished the three children I had in ISS yesterday that because I enjoyed Alfred Noyes' poem, The Highwayman, I memorized it when I was in ninth grade. But wow, that's so long. How do you remember it all? I didn't even bother to go into explanations. But I was taught to memorize from first grade on up. And doubly taught because I went to Catholic school. Believe me, I could say the whole rosary by the time I was 3 months into first grade. And remember which bead was a Hail Mary, which one was an Our Father, which one was the Glory Be, and what to do with the crucifix and the little ones on the short piece at the end. The amount of memorization I did in 3 years in Catholic school should have prepared me to be the memory wizard on a stage. Because we didn't answer our catechism questions in the way we felt like. We memorized and repeated word for word the exact answer in the catechism. Yes, this doesn't necessarily encourage individual spiritual growth, but it's damned good training for your memory. And I don't know any profession, or any job for that matter, where you don't have to remember how to do something more than once. Bullet point number 3 on the successful aspects of being a tough teacher. Failure is an option. We protect our kids from their own mistakes. We baby and coddle and nurse them through school, giving them grades to make them feel good. And then we turn them loose on the world at the age of 18 when there's no more federal money to give them accommodations and say, okay, now you're ready, you go earn a living. And what happens? They get fired from McDonald's because they can't make change. Or they can't remember what somebody ordered long enough to tell the cook in the back what to fix. If we do not allow our children to take the consequences of their actions, both good and bad, we create a society in which no one will have the guts to try anything new. Because inevitably when you try something new, you are not immediately successful. You do not become an expert basketball player the first time you dribble a ball across the floor. you do not become a concert cellist the first time you pick up a bow. If our kids are not allowed to fail, they will never be able to pick themselves back up when they fall down and keep on going. I'm quoting now from the article in the Wall Street Journal. Kids who understand that failure is a necessary aspect of learning actually perform better. In a 2012 study, 111 French sixth graders were given anagram problems that were too difficult for them to solve. One group was then told that failure and trying again are part of the learning process. On subsequent tests, those children consistently outperformed their peers. Because the true value of working at it till you get it right was made obvious to them by experiential knowledge. I can tell my students, it's okay if you get it wrong the first time. I'll help you figure out how to do it right 450,000 times in an hour. But if I give them the right answer, they are never going to understand that somebody is not going to be standing with them the rest of their lives to give them all the answers. Failure has to be an option, ladies and gentlemen. Our kids have to understand that if at first you don't succeed, try again is a positive character trait that creates growth, both as an individual, as a tribe, as a family, as a society, as a nation, and as a world. There is no such thing as perfect every time. There is no such thing as perfect the first time. There is no such thing this side of heaven as perfect anyway. Bullet point number 4 was strict is better than nice. This one I know for a fact, ladies and gentlemen, is true. Because I see it every single day. In addition to being the ISS coordinator and dealing with the little miscreants, I also fill in for teachers in 3 different grade levels and 6 different subjects, not counting physical education. Every single teacher with whom I have worked has said to our coordinator at work, if I need a sub, please give me Mrs. Rowland. And it isn't because I'm nice. It's because I am demanding. I do not put up with inappropriate behavior. I do not countenance laziness, either physical or intellectual. If you do it incorrectly, you go back and do it again until you get it right. And yes, as my friend Yo says, they must do the work. I will not do it for them. And every teacher with whom I've worked and for whom I've subbed, I'm number one on the list to fill in for them if they have to be out. And it isn't because I'm nice. My ISS students think I'm nice. I am stricter than any of their teachers. In my classroom, they are not allowed to talk unless they raise their hand and wait to be called upon. They must complete their work. I will not take excuses. I will listen to reasons, but I will not take excuses. They may not cheat, lie, take things that don't belong to them, lay their hands on the other students without permission, pick up things on my desk, or in any other way behave as if they were two-year-olds. And yet, almost every one of them, when they see me in the halls, they run up and say, "Hi, Mrs. Rowland, give me a hug," or high five. The 3 I had in my classroom yesterday, And I said something about, look, I'm not here to be nice. And all three of them said, but you are nice. You help us. And when we don't understand it, you explain it. Okay? That's what nice is. It's not, that's too hard for you, honey. Tell you what, you sit back here in the corner and count all the red jelly beans for me. Nice is understanding why those children are there. And having the confidence in them to set standards and expect them to give their best to try to achieve them. And I don't mean unrealistic standards. I don't expect my eighth graders to be able to do quantum physics. I can't do quantum physics. I don't expect them to be fluent in Sanskrit, for heaven's sake. But I do expect them, when they're reading something, not to skip a word they don't recognize. And I tell them, if you do, I personally will take you home, chop you up, and feed you to my cats. Now, they know that that's an exaggeration of what I will do, but they know that I'm serious. And if they come to a word when they're reading an assignment, they raise their hand and say, Mrs. Roland, I don't know this word. And I help them sound it out, and I tell them what it means, or if they're fairly good at comprehension, I have them look it up in the dictionary. One young lady that I had in my ISS classroom several years ago gave me more trouble than any six combined. Obstructive, didn't want to do her work, sarcastic, disrespectful, the whole bit. And the last year she was at the middle school, she had an interview with the principal, and he told me what she said. And she said, you know, Mrs. Rowland is the strictest teacher I've ever had, but I learned some stuff when I was in ISS. And I'll tell you something, folks. When I heard that, I was walking about 12 feet off the deck when I got home. I tell my students that I am not there to be their BFF or their mommy or their grandmommy or their nanny. I am there to teach them. I am an adult, and they are not. My function is to give them what I have learned over my 66 years on this earth, both in and out of school. That is my job, that is my vocation, and that is my passion. And my students recognize it. They know, after one day with me, that I have high expectations. Not because I'm trying to make them feel bad, but because I know they can achieve them. I'm quoting now from the article, the bullet point, strict is better than nice. What makes a teacher successful? To find out, starting in 2005, a team of researchers led by Claremont Graduate University Education Professor Mary Poplin spent 5 years observing 31 of the most highly effective teachers, measured by student test scores, in the worst schools of Los Angeles, in neighborhoods like South Central and Watts. Their number one finding? They were strict, she says. None of us expected that. The researchers had assumed that the most effective teachers would lead students to knowledge through collaborative learning and discussion. Instead, they found disciplinarians who relied on traditional methods of explicit instruction like lectures. Quote, the core belief of these teachers was, every student in my room is underperforming based on their potential, and it's my job to do something about it, and I can do something about it, unquote, says Professor Poplin. She reported her findings in a lengthy academic paper. But she says that a fourth grader summarized her conclusions much more succinctly this way. And I'll tell you, the quote I'm going to read now, it could be any one of my kids. When I was in first grade and second grade and third grade, when I cried, my teachers coddled me. When I got to Mrs. T's room, she told me to suck it up and get to work. I think she's right. I need to work harder. Now, if a fourth grader can figure it out, ladies and gentlemen, you would assume that Washington bureaucrats might just get a glimmer, but I suppose that's too much to hope for. I do have a horrible feeling that you have to be brain dead before you run for office in this country. Bullet point number 5. Creativity can be learned. Progressives swear up and down that rote memorization and lectures and a teacher-directed classroom stifles the creativity of our precious, delicate little flower children. That if they're forced to memorize things and sit still and finish their work, that their joyous, creative spirit will be crushed irreparably and they will become nothing but pale, weak copies, not the vibrant, fulfilled human beings that progressives promise them they will be. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a load of bucolic byproduct, the stuff you find on the floor of the stable when you go in to clean the stalls. To quote from the article, the rap on traditional education is that it kills children's creativity. But Temple University psychology professor Robert W. Weisberg's research suggests just the opposite. Professor Weisberg has studied creative geniuses, including Thomas Edison, Frank Lloyd Wright, and Picasso, and has concluded that there is no such thing as a born genius. Most creative giants work ferociously hard and through a series of incremental steps achieve things that appear to the outside world like epiphanies and breakthroughs. Professor Weisberg analyzed Picasso's 1937 masterpiece, Guernica, for instance, which was painted after the Spanish city was bombed by the Germans. The painting is considered a fresh and original concept, but Professor Weisberg found instead that it was closely related to several of Picasso's earlier works and drew upon his study of paintings by Goya and then prevalent Communist Party imagery. The bottom line, Professor Weisberg told me, is that creativity goes back in many ways to the basics. Quote, you have to immerse yourself in a discipline before you create in that discipline. It is built on a foundation of learning the discipline, which is what your music teacher was requiring of you. Unquote. My husband found this out. For approximately 20 years, he was the head of the jewelry repair departments all over the nation for Best Products. His jewelry repair facility trained most of the jewelers who are practicing their profession in Richmond today. And his first command, if you will, was you must follow the steps that I show you. Learn how to do it right my way until you can do it in your sleep. Then you can try to innovate and find a better way. But learn the basic way that works first. If you get that, then you can legitimately take an intuitive leap or try something different. But if you don't learn the basics first, you're not going to discover electricity by sitting there staring at the wall. And his jewelers, the people who worked for him, his apprentices, the people he trained, went on to be successful businessmen and women because he taught them the basic skills they needed to become immersed in their discipline and have the hard work ethic to keep at it until they achieved their creative potential. Jackson Pollock, and Jack the Dripper, as he was called, and his famous little drip paintings. Pollock was a classically trained artist. So was Picasso. So were all of the French Impressionists. So was Van Gogh, for that matter. They got the basics first, and then they took the leap. You can't create Van Gogh's sunflowers if you don't learn how to mix the cotton, pick, and paint correctly to get the strength of color you need. bullet point number 6 on the list of 8 that indicate that tough teachers are more magicians than they are monsters. Grit trumps talent. And it does. If you have grit, if you have stick-to-itiveness, as my mother used to call it, a strong work ethic, as we used to try to instill in our children, then you can take a small degree of talent and make it into an extraordinary degree of skill. Talent without skill doesn't mean much, ladies and gentlemen. I found this portion, this bullet point, very interesting, and I'm going to read to you what the author says under this. In recent years, University of Pennsylvania psychology professor Angela Duckworth has studied spelling bee champs, Ivy League undergrads, and cadets at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, New York, altogether over 2,800 subjects. In all of them, she found that grit, defined as passion and perseverance for long-term goals, is the best predictor of success. In fact, grit is usually unrelated or even negatively correlated with talent. Professor Duckworth, who started her career as a public school math teacher and just won a 2013 MacArthur Genius Grant, developed a grit scale that asks people to rate themselves on a dozen statements like, I finish whatever I begin, and I become interested in new pursuits every few months. When she applied the scale to incoming West Point cadets, she found that those who scored higher were less likely to drop out of the school's notoriously brutal summer boot camp known as Beast Barracks. West Point's own measure, an index that includes SAT scores, class rank, leadership, and physical aptitude, was not able to predict retention. Professor Duckworth believes that grit can be taught. One surprisingly simple factor, she says, is optimism. The belief among both teachers and students that they have the ability to change and thus to improve. In a 2009 study of newly minted teachers, she rated each for optimism, as measured by a questionnaire, before the school year began. At the end of the year, the students whose teachers were optimists had made greater academic gains. Guess who you're hearing, folks? The lady who always sees the glass half full. If you set standards for your kids, either as a parent or as a teacher, you're not setting them to set them up to fail. No one who cares about children would do that. You're setting them to give them the confidence that they can do something that's hard and succeed. If you have confidence, if you believe that anyone can learn something, some people more than others, then you will approach your student in a positive and confident way. Today, I helped out in a self-contained classroom with students with great intellectual difficulties. None of the teachers and paras in that room babied those kids. Not one of them gave them answers or patted them on the head when they behaved inappropriately or said, oh, you can't help it, that's okay. Not one. And those children have made incredible progress, given their limitations, over the year they were there last year and even over the 6 weeks they've been in class so far. Our job as teachers and as parents is to teach our children that their effort is worthwhile and to get them to understand that which we achieve too easily, we will value too lightly. Bullet point number 7 in the list of the 8 aspects of tough teachers and why they work. Praise makes you weak. interesting concept. The author started her article referencing a music teacher she had when she was in high school, who passed away, and thousands of his former students traveled halfway across the country or farther to come to his memorial service and to praise him. And he was not nice, and he was not sweet, and he was not lovable. He expected the best out of his students, and they exerted every muscle they had to give it to him. She says, "My old teacher, Mr. K, seldom praised us. His highest compliment was, 'Not bad.' It turns out he was onto something. Stanford psychology professor Carol Dweck has found that 10-year-olds praised for being smart became less confident. But kids told that they were hard workers became more confident and better performers. The whole point of intelligence praise is to boost confidence and motivation, but both were gone in a flash," wrote Professor Dweck in a 2007 article in the journal Educational Leadership. "If success meant they were smart, then struggling meant they were not." And I've seen this over and over and over again. Kids who have trouble understanding something give up without even making a real first try. And they sit there and say, "Well, I'm stupid," or "I'm too dumb." It's because this is the attitude they are getting from the way they are being taught. If they can't do it on first try, somebody fills in the blanks for them, or somebody gives them an answer. Or somebody says, "Oh, but you write so neatly." It is utterly ridiculous, ladies and gentlemen. I wonder if the crazy lady in D.C. firing at the Capitol happened to be a teacher. I can tell you it was not I, okay? I promise. I was at work. I had nothing to do with it. Then I was driving home. But I often wonder sometimes if Washington isn't going to drive every single one of us to mayhem. Not because we really want to hurt anybody, but because there's no outlet for the incredible anger and frustration we feel at the downfall of our nation, perpetrated on us by the people we chose to protect this nation and our rights. The whole idea of we refuse to negotiate on a law that nobody wants, that is unworkable, financially unsustainable, and does exactly the opposite of what it was purported to do for us, should be a pretty clear indication that whatever educated the people who are sitting up there in Congress and in the White House didn't do a very good job. Okay, now this last one, ladies and gentlemen, is super important. I think this bullet point, number 8, is one of the most important in the list. See if you agree with me when you hear the author's words on stress makes you strong. A 2011 University at Buffalo study found that a moderate amount of stress in childhood promotes resilience. Psychology professor Mark D. Seary gave healthy undergraduates a stress assessment based on their exposure to 37 different kinds of significant negative events, such as death or illness of a family member. Then he plunged their hands into ice water. The students who had experienced a moderate number of stressful events actually felt less pain than those who had experienced no stress at all. I'm a living witness to that, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sitting here discussing education on the internet, after working a full-time job, a little over 6 months after I lost my husband. And if you want stress, try losing your mate. I'm not hiding in a corner, weeping into a bucket. I'm not calling all of my relatives and my friends 7 times a day to be reassured and comforted. I'm not seeking medical assistance or government assistance to help me through my stressful, traumatic grief. I am doing my best to be a productive person. I am learning to live with being one, where before I was part of two. I am teaching children and taking joy in watching them learn something they didn't know before. And yes, I have my down days. And I have my sit in the corner and cry times. And the loneliness is bitter. But I would dishonor my beloved David if I became someone other than the woman he loved. And sitting in a corner, patting my poor little soul and saying, "There, there now," would not be the woman he loved. I don't recommend losing your mate as a way to increase your strength. I'd much rather it had been an easier method. But it is what it is. And the fact that I lost both my parents to cancer and my beloved grandmother to the same thing when I was 16, went through a divorce, nursed my own husband through chemotherapy and radiation. I have not had a stress-free life, but I have not had a sad or deprived or horrible life simply because there have been many stressful events in it. As painful as they were and will remain for as long as I live, I am strong enough to do something positive with my life. Not because I'm looking for praise or wealth or fame, but because it's the right thing to do. You get back up and you keep on going. The rest of the bullet point, I think, will illustrate. Having this history of dealing with these negative things leads people to be more likely to have a propensity for general resilience, Professor Series told me. They are better equipped to deal with even mundane, everyday stressors. Professor Series' findings build on research by University of Nebraska psychologist Richard Diestenbeyer, who pioneered the concept of toughness. The idea that dealing with even routine stresses makes you stronger. How would you define routine stresses? Quote, mundane things like having a hard-ass kind of teacher, unquote, Professor Siri says. My tough old teacher, Mr. K, could have written the book on any one of these principles. Admittedly, individually, these are forbidding precepts. Cold, unyielding, and kind of scary. But collectively, they convey something very different. Confidence. At their core is the belief, the faith, really, in students' ability to do better. There is something to be said about a teacher who is demanding and tough, not because he thinks students will never learn, but because he is so absolutely certain that they will. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what makes our tough teachers into the magicians they are, and not the monsters that progressive educational experts would think, would have you believe they are. Being tough, okay, is a positive thing. We're not a piece of steak that the children are supposed to chew and swallow with ease. We are coaches. We are their first experience after their parents of what you might call life coaching. There is no one who can come to a point in their life where they can say with perfect truth and factually that there is nothing more for them to learn. My friend Linda says, life coach, mentor, sage, and sensei. Yeah, pretty much it. That's our job, folks. That's what teachers do. And if your child comes home and says, Mr. Jones was really mean. He hollered at us today just because we were laughing in class. I'll bet you if you heard Mr. Jones' version of events, that was the only way that Mr. Jones could make his voice heard over the horseplay that was going on, spreading from student to student. Children are not objective about life, ladies and gentlemen. They do not have the experience or the intellectual ability to be objective. They gauge things through their emotional reactions, just like progressives. One of the reasons why I say that all progressives are stuck at age 12 with very little potential of making 18. Children are, as my friend Linda says, naturally self-centered. She is exactly correct. If, just like progressives, as she says, how right you are, the traditional right and left in the political spectrum has always fallen out into the left is discontented with the system because either it feels empathy for those who are unsuccessful within it, or they themselves are unsuccessful within it, and they shouldn't have to feel sad and bad. Somebody needs to do something. The political right generally is politically right on the right side of the spectrum because they are successful in the system. They don't need it to change because they understand how to achieve within it. And generally, they have gotten their achievement by falling down several times and getting back up until they could walk straight. Only the immature, ladies and gentlemen, buy into progressive ideology. That is why it is so popular on college campuses. 18 to 25-year-olds have about as much common sense as a dead cockroach. They are all emotional, altruistic idealists who are firmly convinced that nobody older than they has any clue about how the real world operates. The real world being their particular circle of friends and their friends' ideas and their professors' ideas and what was said at the latest keg party and who is going to pledge what sorority or fraternity and how can I look cool and interesting to that girl who lives in the room over there in that dorm that I want to get into my bed tonight. Progressives, liberals, etc., operate on emotion. They understand and use the desire of human beings to feel good about something, usually themselves or their situation. If every single one of us spent the rest of our lives on a college campus having our education paid for by mommy and daddy, or having a student loan that we're convinced we shouldn't have to pay back, yeah, maybe we could have a happy progressive world. I don't want to live in it. I did that. I lived on a college campus. And yes, my parents did pay for my education. But guess what? I grew out of it. I grew up when I found out that mommy and daddy were not going to pay me a salary. And that if I didn't pay attention to what my boss wanted out of me and do it, I wasn't going to get a salary. I was going to get my delicate little derriere fired. And even though I thought my boss was a jerk, I still wanted to eat. So I was careful not to indicate to my boss that I thought he was a jerk. At least not directly. It doesn't mean that I changed my opinion. He's still a jerk. But I decided when I wanted to leave his employ and not the other way around. And that freedom, ladies and gentlemen, that ability to say, wait a minute, I don't like this situation. I'm going to step out and find something better, is not going to be in our children's arsenal if all we do is tell them, oh, poor baby, I know this is too hard. We'll figure out a way for somebody else to do it for you. We have a student at our school for whom I feel deep compassion. This child is incapable of walking, has a feeding tube, spends her day in a wheelchair or on a tilted board, and is wheeled around by her aide in and out of a classroom, have diapers changed, etc., every single day. Because our public schools must, by law and the interpretation of law, provide a free, appropriate public education to all children. This child can learn nothing, can participate in nothing. And when in discomfort, cries and whimpers and distracts everybody else in the self-contained classroom in which she's placed. We have another child in our school who has Down syndrome and whose mother is withholding him from school because she is demanding that he have not only a one-on-one aide, but an ASL, American Sign Language, interpreter with him all during the school day, and that interpreter signs to the child and interprets the child's signing to the teacher in every class he's in. The child is hearing. He has difficulty articulating clearly. He does not want to sign. He doesn't like it. He doesn't want to be signed to because it makes him stand out. He wants to try to talk. But Mama wants him to have two people, in addition to teachers and special ed teachers, devoting 100% of their attention to her son 100% of the time when he is in school. And she is keeping him out of school until she gets what she wants. In the, I think, mistaken assumption that that somehow harms the school. Yeah, my friend Yo has it right. Mama is an idiot. Uh-huh. That's pretty doggone close. Having a one-on-one aide myself to a child with problems, I understand the incredible amount of effort and work and time a parent puts into a severely handicapped or disabled child. It is exhausting. And I understand the desire to have a little vacation from that. But I do not understand the thinking pattern that says the public schools are there to provide that vacation for you. The concept of the Americans with Disabilities Act was to provide access to government services for people who were physically challenged, to use the politically correct term, and unable to enter government buildings without a great deal of help. As it was originally constituted, it was a good piece of legislation and very necessary. Any citizen of the United States should have access to those services for which his tax money pays. But like every other good idea in this wonderful nation of ours, once the progressives got hold of it, it became broadened to include anything and everything. And then it got applied to education. And I remember when that happened. I was working as a tutor. And I believe I mentioned this on one of our shows. This child had a great deal of difficulty memorizing times tables and being able to access individual multiplication facts randomly from memory. She could write all of her times tables on paper and get them all perfectly, but she couldn't just pull out what 6 times 7 was. So what we did for her was have her write out all her times tables, and then she could use that table that she wrote for multiplication facts when she was doing multiplication problems. And it worked beautifully. We tried and tried and tried, her parents and my boss and I, to get the schools to allow her to do that for her math tests. They refused. That was before learning disabilities came under the ADA as being a legitimate disability and intellectual accommodation, reasonable accommodation. And that was a legitimate disability, a legitimate learning problem that was an easy fix that would let the child learn to do the procedure. With a simple extra 10 minutes to write down her times tables and then use that when she was doing her math. When they classified learning disabilities as under the ADA, they opened Pandora's box, because then they classified absolutely everything as a disability. You need to look, ladies and gentlemen, at the list of things, what defines a disability in the amendment to the Act. You can find it online. You will be utterly flabbergasted. Also, progressives interpret reasonable in an extraordinarily peculiar way. A progressive would interpret reasonable accommodations in the workplace for someone who was deaf as allowing that person to be a teller in an off-track betting parlor. Now, they haven't gone that far, because nobody who was deaf has actually applied to be a teller in an off-track betting parlor, as far as I know, but reasonable doesn't mean the same thing to a progressive that it does to someone who can think. The child writing out her times tables was a reasonable accommodation. She was still writing her multiplication facts. What she was doing was putting her collective memory on a sheet of paper so she could do selective memory from it, because her selective memory skills were poor. She wasn't cheating. Nobody was giving her a set of times tables. She was having to write them all out herself. And yes, it took a little more time. But strangely enough, ladies and gentlemen, after about a month or two of doing that, she didn't need to write them anymore. The only ones she needed to write down were the sevens, because they confused her. The other ones, by writing them out like that, she had improved her random access memory, simply by seeing them over and over and over again. But unfortunately, tough teachers like those mentioned in the article, and the procedures and the classroom attitudes that they model, under progressive rule, which is what we've got right now, are seen as evil, horrible monsters who want to squash our children's creativity and make them timid little rabbits who cry and go home and kill themselves because the teacher was mean to them. Well, I'll tell you what, folks, kids are not that fragile. Ever read Lord of the Flies? They are not that fragile. We make them fragile by attempting to put them in nice little pillow-lined boxes where no harsh anything ever touches them. And then, when they're done with their schooling, they go out and join the folks that occupy Wall Street. Or wait for the Obama stash to buy their car or pay their mortgage. We created this entitlement generation, ladies and gentlemen, and we must change the way we educate children or we will no longer have a country. Have a caller on the line? Hang on, folks. Hello there.
Hi, Miss Terry. You know it's me.
I know it's you, Linda. How are you doing, dear?
Doing great. Enjoying the show. And I think you had touched on these points a few months ago, the bullet mm-hmm. points regarding mm-hmm. progressives and bullying and things like that. And it's just good to go back over it because this is what's happening. I did put in the chat room earlier, you know, when you were talking about the math skills and the rote memorization sometimes of things like your multiplications, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
This is very telling because with Common Core, they're looking at fuzzy math and also these estimations. And I said,
yes.
Oh, that's going to work out well if you want to be an architect or maybe a building supervisor.
Oh, my God, yes.
Putting up a house.
I'm not going to live
in
it.
Can you imagine what?
Sorry.
Oh, my God. I mean, mm-hmm. these people are crazy, Terry.
They are.
They've gone off the rails, babe. I mean, and the bullying part, look what Obama's doing to the veterans at the War Memorial.
The World War II Memorial. I know. If that isn't bullying, I don't know what is.
You know what? What Mark Levin said last night, it got us going on Facebook, and everybody was cheering mm-hmm. him. He's mm-hmm. I think, I don't know if you heard about it. Well, I actually read the transcript and heard him. He said, he was so livid. He said, you touch one hair on the head of those vets, and I'll have 500 million people, or mm-hmm. half a million people on that mall mm-hmm. in a heartbeat.
Amen.
Because we can do it.
And you know something?
Yeah.
It's... They refused to be bullied. They didn't sit
yes.
there and cry in their wheelchairs.
No, they weren't the greatest generation for nothing. And
exactly.
And you talked about, I'll tell you, you know, this guy's pushing the envelope in the nudge, shove, and shoot category, let me tell you. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he's just, he's on everybody's last nerve right now.
he's definitely on mine. And, I used my own current situation, Linda, not because I'm looking
right.
for pity or anything like that, but I know I have not exactly been stress-free my whole life, but doggone it, I'm still here.
You know, Terry, that's part of life. I mean, none of
yes,
us are going to get through
is.
This unscathed. I mean,
no,
you know, I've
aren't.
Had a loss in my family. I've had losses in my family, all my grandparents, of course, and my dad almost 4 years ago. You know, this is part of life. When you know,
yes.
you're born, we live, we die. I mean, that's it. You know, you're not getting out of this alive. But
no.
the progressives, are, like
cost.
I said, they're crazy. Oh, my God, my goodness. I mean, even a cat or a bird when you're a kid, it's horrible. You know, it's not fun. But,
no.
but the other thing, when you're looking at everybody gets a trophy, now they're going to Common
yeah.
Core. And when
yeah.
you talk about teaching and you're trying – now they expect you to give them the answers. Well, how can you be self-sufficient in anything if somebody just hands it to you?
You
Whether
can't.
And
that's what progressives don't want. They don't want us self-sufficient,
course.
Because
no.
we can't
oh.
be controlled as easily.
Right. It's like you talked about Picasso and the great artists. I don't care whether it's painting or math or architecture or a violinist or a concert pianist or a Paloma Herrera, which would be a premier dancer and, you know, mm-hmm. ballerina, you don't start at the top. Nobody starts at the top. You don't take your first plie with point shoes on, excuse me, and you don't play your first violin note on a Stradivarius. Hello?
That's right.
I don't know.
You don't.
My God.
Nope. You get, and, nope. You play it on the beat-up old one that you rent from the school. I did.
And thank God we still have teachers here. I take from Miss Terry. She was ABT trained. She was in company. She makes the kids wear their hair correctly. They have to wear the black leotard and the tights, and everything is perfect.
Yep.
And you stand straight, and you don't talk in class, and you never chew gum, or you're out. And thank God that the traditions are kept, and it's still done in French. I love the terminology. And that's been 600 years of tradition, and it's amazing. And, of course, now these people want to be there, and their parents are paying good money. So, naturally, it's like heaven for
Well, and that's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons I loved the tutoring firm, because the parents were paying me. They were paying us to give their kids tuition, and we had the option of saying, "I'm sorry, we're obviously not right for this child." In other words, say, "Get this little beast out of here. We won't keep him." The public schools can't do that. Do you know what it takes to get a kid permanently expelled?
You've got to fight.
You have got to fight the parents bringing lawsuits against you for discriminating against their kid because he's fill in the blank. It could be anything. You've got whisper campaigns. You've got newspaper editorials. You've got the idiot media. This poor little child deserves an education, and you're being unkind to him. And yet they turn around and expel a kid for an invisible gun, for God's sake.
Oh, I know. I mean, no, this is upside down, and you know it. This is why everybody's so up in arms, and I'm glad that Mark did what he did. And he says, you've been warned. He said it twice, and he was so mad. I mean, and everybody on Facebook, not just our group, but everybody else says, let's go, man. Let's roll. They were ticked
off.
Believe
me. You know, I was thinking about Tom Clancy today. He passed away, as you know. And I have been a fan of his books. I loved Hunter Red October, Cardinal of the Kremlin, Executive Orders. I loved them. And the man was a conservative from the word go. And his heroes were real heroes. They weren't kumbaya, I love you, wait till I can be a martyr, oh, how happy I am. They went out and frickin' did something to make it better.
Sure.
And we are not raising heroes. We are raising whiny little brats. To look to everybody else, and it's always somebody else's fault and never theirs. And there are times.
The let's play the pass the buck game at the top of the of the heap is
amen. Oh yes, yeah. Well, you realize
Teflon. Oh my God!
I'll tell you. You know what, darling? I'm a member of the New Camp Tea Party and the Richmond Tea Party, so the government shutdown is my fault.
Of course, and you're a terrorist.
I did
and a jihadist,
I did
by the way.
And an anarchist. I'm an anarchist.
Oh, my God.
I run around
with
a bomb
guys,
every day.
These
did you
guys
ever
are
see,
like a... Go ahead.
Do you remember the movie with Paul Newman and Sophia Loren where he was the anarchist and she was the Italian peasant girl and, you know, the wound up being a titled lady and... married to David Niven, the Lord, and actually she wasn't. She was married to her anarchist all the time, and all of her kids were his. I just have a picture of me running around like Paul Newman with a little black bomb with a fuse sticking out. Here I am, Tea Party anarchist. Everybody shut down the government right now. You know, I am so responsible for this. Yeah,
it's so ridiculous. There's no shutdown. There's like 15% of, non-essentials, I could name some more non-essentials.
I never can figure out, if they're non-essential, what in the hell are they doing there?
Well, because we're stupid and we keep paying taxes, and we're letting them get away with this. Now we know the gloves are off, the masks are off. Boehner's been outed as a complete traitor
And
in fact, I think Glenn said he should be told to not only just step down as speaker, but get the hell out of that house. Just leave.
Yes, he should.
Just resign.
Yes, he should.
That evil little... Oh, what a miserable snake.
Well, I despise a hypocrite, darling. I always have. One of the reasons I can't... Madam Pelosi. And a friend of mine, former neighbor, came by last night. We got to talking about politics, and he's as rabid and much more profanely vocal about it than I am. But at any rate, We were talking about Nancy P and her constant stating that she's a good Catholic who believes in abortion.
Oh,
well,
right.
I'm sorry, honey. You can believe in anything you want, but don't call yourself a Catholic and say you believe in abortion. Call yourself what you want, but not Catholic.
She's
if you're
a
Catholic,
she's
yeah, she is.
Absolute.
She's a hypocrite.
God.
She's a freaking liar.
And
you cannot
and
be a practicing Catholic and believe in that.
Well,
you know?
I think these people believe their own merit, you know, that flows. It's
yes.
just amazing to me. And I don't know what color her eyes are, but they should be brown. I don't know.
Yes, given how full she is of it, yes, you're quite correct. But, you know, the pathetic part is that, unfortunately, I don't know of any human being, with a possible exception of perhaps Adolf Hitler or Saddam Hussein or possibly Mao Zedong, who is purely evil. Most people have both yin and yang. They have both good and evil in them. It's the nature of human beings.
Right.
We are
I
not.
Think Stalin was in there too.
Yeah. He makes the bill too.
God.
But Adolf Hitler liked his dog, for God's sake. I mean, and he did have a dog. The thing is, no one is purely evil, but no one is purely good either.
Right.
We all
right.
have our dark spots. But the point
sure.
is, you try to eradicate them. You try
right.
to work toward bettering yourself because
you
can't better somebody else.
Yeah.
You can't better somebody else. I tell my kids every cotton picking day in ISS, the only person in your life over whom you will ever have 100% control is yourself. You cannot control other people, but you can control yourself. And if
right.
you don't learn how, then you let others control you.
Sure.
When you give in, when you lose it, when you react to the kind of bullying, taunting crap, then they win because that's why they do it. And kids, it's understandable. They don't have the maturity to understand. They don't have the intellectual capacity
right.
as yet to make the rational, logical decisions that we adults supposedly are capable of making. And you cannot expect them to. And you cannot expect them to guide their own education, because if they did, everybody would be sitting in a classroom with a Wii controller, and that's all they'd do.
Yeah, and the Nintendo games and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
And then when they get to be, 13 or 14, sitting in a classroom with porn. they aren't
yeah.
interested in anything else.
Well, that's
so
because they're immature. They're kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how can anybody with any sense or understanding of the maturation, progressive growth of the human being say anything so stupid as a child-directed classroom?
Well, because, they want it.
They're nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Maybe. And I think that there's a method to their madness. They do want everything upside down, and they want the
mm-hmm.
demolition of the family and the parents' rights and all that stuff. I mean, because then you've got the Borg Collective, then you've got the FEMA camps, and you've got anything else you want to name. You've got the Ukraine. You've got it all. I mean,
yep.
This is where it leads to, and you and I know that. And everybody who's out there in our chat rooms have read, and they know as well because they're educated.
Because they understand the absolute, utter truth of the statement, if you do not learn from history, you are doomed to repeat it. And we aren't teaching our children anything
right.
that resembles that common sense view. We are not.
And they need to know.
Them.
Yeah, they need to know that history, because then they can
yeah.
they can avoid people like Barry. And you know,
mm-hmm.
it's human nature when you have that type of authoritarian bully, and you
mm-hmm.
allow them to run amok and feed their own psychosis like Hitler's. That's
mm-hmm.
what's going to happen. There's no other way for
yes.
this to end.
Yes.
You know,
and
so that's what we're dealing with.
And the way the progressives are going at it is the more professional victims they can create, the more people with a grievance that they can
sure.
create, the bigger their power base, and the more extravagant their promises that we're going to redress your grievances, not in a sensible way that benefits everybody, but we're going to give you something, and we're going to take it away from that evil guy who has it and give it to you
sure.
because he's not nice and you are.
It's
kindergarten sandbox.
And like on Glenn's show, the gentleman who wrote about the only way to stop this is to stand up to them and call their bluff, literally. Just
yep.
say no. I mean,
yep.
that's it.
Exactly.
You have to do
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And unfortunately,
yep.
I I am not looking forward to a total meltdown and a breakdown of the societal and
governmental
function.
No, I'm not either.
I do not want a massive EMP to put us back on primitive level. But I do think that the only way that most of these people who follow creatures like mm-hmm. the object that is in the Oval Office, the only way that they are going to discover that that object is rotten to the core is when it directly
right.
affects them and they can't get somebody else's stuff anymore.
That's
because
true.
We're going to be standing in front of our stuff with a rifle and we're going to shoot them if they take it.
Well, that's true, because there will be chaos and there will be anarchy, and you know that. I mean, if that thin veil of stability breaks down, oh boy.
That's why I
buy as much ammo as I do.
No, I understand. Believe me, I do understand. And one of the reasons I'm glad that there's only one real easy road into where I live. It makes it difficult in hurricane season, but I can deal with that. Although
right.
they did fix the road, and it doesn't flood when the river's high and the creek swells and all that other fun stuff. But unfortunately, they placed the guardrails way farther in, and now it's just barely wide enough for two cars to go in opposite directions.
Oh, God.
The wonders of Virginia Department of Transportation engineers.
Oh, sure.
Oh, my Lord. When government does it, you can bet it's going to be effed up somewhere. Pardon my language.
There you go.
But that's pretty much it. The Economist, Milton Friedman, I guess, who said that if the government was in charge of the Sahara, the world would soon have a shortage of sand.
Oh, of course.
And, oh, my God.
They would find a way. Yep. There you go. Okay,
and
I'm going to let you wrap it up, and thanks so much for taking my call. It was fabulous.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, sweetheart. I love to hear that lovely California voice of yours.
Thank you, Bob. God bless, and I'll see you in the chat room. Bye-bye.
I'll be here. Bye-bye, sweetie. My good friend, Miss Linda Sills, my bird of paradise, that strange and rare bird of paradise, a California conservative, and you'll want to catch Linda's show every Wednesday night. She's always faithful. She joins us for all of our shows, and that woman works like a demon to try to get people to open their eyes, wake up, and smell the coffee. Because she knows, as you and I know, ladies and gentlemen, that there is no such thing as a perfect world, and even if there were, government would not be able to create it. If you look at the success of government throughout the history of mankind, its record is pretty blessed bad. It is individuals, ladies and gentlemen, who create, individuals who inaugurate change that makes life better for everyone. Individuals who innovate, individuals who think outside the box, individuals who dream and wish and try and get back up again when they fall. It is individuals and individuals only who move us toward a better world, not a perfect world. My friend Rod says, I better be careful, or I'll give Linda a big head and her hat won't fit. Believe me, I'll buy her a new hat, Rod. Any size she wants. And besides, I'm very proud of my own humility. Why shouldn't she be proud of hers? It's in fashion. The president is. Thank you all so much for joining us tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And you have my apologies for the last 2 weeks when I couldn't do the show. First time was a computer glitch, and last week was a me glitch. It was a stressful week. And yes, I am subject to stress. And sometimes it's a little more stress than I can easily handle. But usually, I manage to pull myself together. Most of the time. Get back up and try again. And I try my very, very hardest to model that for the students I teach and the people I call my friends. Because I do understand that I will never be able to control anyone other than myself. And if I fail in self-control, it's my job to teach myself to do better the next time. We'll be back again next Thursday here on Blog Talk Radio for another episode of Patriot Education. And if anybody has any ideas of a topic directly connected with public education or private education or education in general, just come on to our website, www.patriotfamilys.com, and give me a suggestion. Tell me what you'd like to hear about. If you have something to say, if you have something on your mind, give us a call here on Patriot Education every Thursday night at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll be here, barring computer glitches and an overload of dealing with the stupid all week. I promise you I will do my very best to be here. And I'm hoping that all of you, my friends in the chat room, Bill and Doc and Echo, Linda and Lonnie and Rod and Yolanda, that all of you will be back again next week, and all of you out there listening in the Ethernet will come by again too. I appreciate all of you more than words can convey. I thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. I thank you for your willingness to listen, and I thank you for your desire to learn. I wish I could have every single one of you in a classroom, and I don't mean ISS, because I don't think you need in-school suspension, ladies and gentlemen. I think you need to be out there in the middle of the world and in the middle of the auditorium speaking what you believe, telling the truth about what you see, and understanding that you are the nation. Your voices matter. Your ideas matter. And your concerns matter. Thanks again for joining us. As always, all my love to my greatest fan.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.